This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Lisa Miller. This Monday, a Clive comeback. Clive Palmer promises to repay millions of dollars to workers at his nickel refinery. What are the chances he'll be a candidate again? And whether you're a fan, a fanatic, or simply ambivalent, it's hard to ignore the arrival of the final season of Game of Thrones.
Do you do special things for the finale each season?
The finale is dress up night. So I myself have a dragon onesie. One of the dogs has a dragon costume, so that covers the dragon front.
Scott Morrison and Bill Shorten have taken their campaigns to marginal seats in Melbourne, honing their messages on the economy and healthcare. But the electoral battleground is complex, with everything from problems with local roads to national leadership feeding into the major parties' campaigns. Political reporter Melissa Clark joins us live from Canberra. Melissa, the official election campaign has really only just begun, with the leaders on the hustings for a few days, but the messages seem to have been consistent so far. They're focusing on tax, infrastructure and health.
That's right. For Scott Morrison and the Liberals and Nationals, it is all about the economy, and they will talk about tax cuts and infrastructure and how that feeds into the economic health of the nation. And they're showing that by continuing to visit small businesses. And today in Melbourne, the side of the road where they intend to spend $154 million upgrading roads in marginal seats in Melbourne's outer eastern suburbs. For Bill Shorten and for the Labor Party, it's all about healthcare, and in particular, their promises to help cancer patients. He's in Melbourne's outer eastern suburbs today as well, visiting a hospital to talk about their election promise to put $250 million in to help cut elective surgery waiting lists. So they're the issues that are being focused on. And the strategy is pretty clear from the two leaders too. For Scott Morrison, his message is consistently, don't vote Bill Shorten, a very personal approach. And the strategy from Bill Shorten is don't waste a vote by sending it somewhere else. So he's clearly worried about voters being complacent about the lead the Labor Party has in the polls so far.
Now, there was a big splash when Labor's funding promise for cancer patients was made, but now the details seem to be coming under more scrutiny.
It was a big promise, $2.3 billion to help cancer patients. It was the centrepiece of Labor's budget reply. And as this campaign is rolling out, they're slowly revealing more details of what that money will fund. They are saying that part of that funding will go to supporting a new Medicare item that cancer specialists can use, but only if they completely bulk bill the cancer treatments involved. Now, the coalition is accusing Labor of miscalculating that, saying that specialists will be left out of pocket, that there'll be a $6 billion gap. Labor is saying they have accounted for that, and specialists will have to take part in a robust marketplace. Here's the Health Minister, Greg Hunt, and the Shadow Treasurer, Chris Bowen, duking it out on RN Breakfast this morning.
That would represent a 90% cut in some cases for the fees that the specialists would receive. They have no idea what they're doing. They made a false promise and they were caught out saying that they would virtually eliminate out-of-pocket costs.
Of course, oncologists can make a judgment about what services they provide and how they charge it, of course. But there will be a new bulk billing-only Medicare item which is not currently available. Of course, people suffering from cancer can ask their oncologist, well, which Medicare schedule are you going to charge me under? Will I have out-of-pocket costs? Or will I not have out-of-pocket costs, and can I go to a doctor which is using the new Medicare item?
No surprises, Melissa, that Victoria is one of the key states in this election. The coalition is worried, isn't it?
It certainly is. It's not just seats that are ultra-marginal like Corangamite and Chisholm, but Labor is making a big play for seats like Latrobe, Casey and Deakin, all in the outer eastern suburbs that should be safe but really aren't. And they're pressing those points by pointing to the fact that many of the sitting members there were ones who supported Peter Dutton in the leadership spill because they think that will help the Labor Party in Victoria.
Now, of course, the state election there saw the Labor Premier Dan Andrews return to government with an emphatic win. So how does Scott Morrison handle the unpopularity of Liberals?
This is an interesting one to see his approach, and particularly given the Victorian state government is now funding an advertising campaign that is criticising the Commonwealth government for cuts to healthcare. But Scott Morrison isn't complaining. He's in fact emphasising that he works well with the Labor Premier, Dan Andrews, perhaps seeing that the public has really backed his approach on infrastructure. It worked successfully for them at the state election. So Scott Morrison is saying that he will work with Dan Andrews. Here he is.
He'll put on the red team shirt and he'll say what the Labor Party expects him to say. But what I do know will be the case is that we're both professionals. We both understand the importance of delivering the infrastructure Victorians need, and that's what we have been doing. And I've appreciated working with the Andrews government to that end. Yeah, we have our differences from time to time, as you'd expect, but we'll get on with the job.
That's Scott Morrison, and it was Melissa Clark speaking to us from Canberra. Well, as you've heard, one of the issues in this election campaign is transport infrastructure. Nowhere is it more important than in the state of Victoria, considering that Melbourne is Australia's fastest growing city. Connie Agius spoke to Melburnians about the challenges they face on the morning commute.
Good morning, customers.
Thousands of commuters travel to Southern Cross train station in Melbourne's CBD from the city's fringes every day. One of them is Lucy, who travels 50 kilometres each way from the western suburb of Melton.
There's not enough public transport for people getting around, and I don't think the services are up to scratch. I'm from Melton, so I have to get Beeline, so they're worse than Metro. We get every morning without fail, there's a cancellation. And there's always roadworks and different stuff happening day and night.
What are the roads like out on the fringes of Melbourne?
They're pretty bad too. They need to be all looked at, I think. The travelling times it takes everyone to get to different places. The roads itself, like I've had a tyre that nearly had some damage done to it through all the potholes, and I think most of the country roads are pretty bad. They need to be looked at.
Fellow commuter Duncan moved to Melbourne from New South Wales 18 months ago. He travels around Victoria for work.
With my job, I'm driving using the major roads. I'm taking public transport and I'm using both metro and regional trains. And generally, I believe that more money should be spent on road infrastructure than tram and train infrastructure.
Why road infrastructure?
I think there just seems to be a lot more people taking the roads, and with the housing situation, having to live further and further away, that people would benefit from better road infrastructure than they would from the public transport system.
On the other side of Melbourne CBD is another major train station, Flinders Street. And from there, some commuters are taking replacement buses on their journey.
I live right at Mordialloc, and you have to get a train to Caulfield, then a bus. And then you have to do a lot of walking to where you're going. But that's because of all the construction work that they're doing.
What about in terms of population growth? And is Melbourne's transport, both road and train, keeping up with the demand?
Well, if yesterday is any indication, we certainly haven't got enough. I'd say we need more trains and probably more tram too also.
Dr. Crystal Legacy is a senior lecturer in urban planning at the University of Melbourne. She says there are two major challenges that the next government must address in Victoria.
One of the key challenges is that there are parts of Melbourne that just don't have access to good quality public transport. So these are areas that are typically out in the outer suburban regions of metropolitan Melbourne, where people are left dependent on their cars to get access to jobs and services, which are typically concentrated in the CBD. The second challenge, what we need, is an integrated, holistic approach to addressing transportation challenges. And we need to move away from solutions, quote-unquote solutions, that just reproduce those problems.
That was the University of Melbourne's Dr. Crystal Legacy ending that report from Connie Agius. Clive Palmer has promised to pay millions of dollars in entitlements to workers who were left out of pocket when his North Queensland nickel refinery collapsed in 2016. The move comes 3 days before the businessman and former federal MP is expected to confirm if he's going to re-enter the political fray by either vying for the seat of Herbert or having a go at the Senate. Mr. Palmer denies the payouts are a political move, insisting it's about helping the city of Townsville recover after February's devastating floods. Stephanie Smale reports.
Clive Palmer says Townsville is suffering and he wants to help.
Townsville seems to be at rock bottom now, so we need to really come up and get the community going. Everybody, regardless of politics or their views, should get together for the community to ensure all people can have employment and growth.
It's been 3 years since his company, Queensland Nickel, collapsed, left owing debts of about $300 million to creditors and the federal government, who covered entitlements for the 800 people who lost their jobs. Now there's a payout offer on the table for those former workers who have been asked to fill out a form to claim what they missed out on. He wants to reopen the refinery too. Mr. Palmer denies the move has any bearing on the legal battle he's currently fighting with liquidators, who are trying to freeze his assets to pay the workers, creditors and the federal government.
There's no admission at all, because the person who sacked these people was the administrator. She confirmed that we offered to have all the employees transferred and we offered to pay out all the creditors. That's really all we can do, or anyone could do in that sort of situation. It's unfortunate for the people of Townsville that things went the way they did through politics. But we've got to put that aside and we've got to come back and provide jobs for people, because this town's suffering and people need employment. And there's no one else that's going to employ people in Townsville. There's no one else here with large amounts of money that wants to invest.
The announcement comes just days before Mr. Palmer's United Australia Party announces its candidate for the Townsville-based seat of Herbert. It's one of the country's most marginal seats, with Labor's Cathy O'Toole holding on by a tiny 0.02% margin. It could be Mr. Palmer himself, but he wouldn't be drawn on that today, or whether a Senate bid might be an option.
Well, I can't presume that I'll be the candidate. You know, it depends what the party decides who'll be the candidate. So on Thursday, we'll be in a much better position to answer those questions.
A multi-million dollar billboard, television and social media advertising campaign has been promoting the reshaped United Australia Party, including a controversial take on a Twisted Sister hit, prompting the band to distance itself from the party. Australia ain't gonna cop it. Asked today whether he believed the timing of the payout announcement would be helpful, Mr. Palmer returned to his theme of rescuing Townsville from the floods.
Well, it may not, but the critical aspects was no one could have foreseen the devastation in this city caused by the floods. They came along and we had to have a look at those and make stock of them and think that something needs to be done to turbocharge the economy and get the town going. These sort of decisions, which involve millions of dollars, can't be made on the spot in one day. They've got to go through a proper process, which we've now done in our corporation, and we've made sure that funds would be available to assist those people, and also additional funds would be available to start the refinery.
Mr. Palmer says it's unclear how much will be paid out to former staff, but he says there's about $400 million ready in the bank.
Stephanie Smale reporting. This is The World Today. Experts are calling for the stability of quad bikes to be urgently re-examined after two boys died in separate accidents at the weekend. The boys, aged 7 and 9, tragically died after their quad bikes rolled over and crushed them on their rural properties in Tasmania and Western Australia. Only last weekend, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission released its final report into quad bike safety, urging a dramatic overhaul of government regulation. Sarah White reports.
Quad bikes are extremely popular, especially on rural properties, but their instability often causes riders to lose control. Countless videos of quad bike accidents appear online, and statistics show the bikes now cause up to 16 deaths a year around Australia. On the weekend, two boys aged 7 and 9 died in separate accidents after their quad bikes rolled over and tragically crushed them, bringing the number of deaths to 7 this year. Paediatric surgeon Dr. Michael E told ABC Radio Hobart that the Tasmanian government should have acted on recommendations of age restrictions and tighter licensing and training.
We really need to rally all community to support this. And I would go as far as to say we need to tell our politicians It's time to act now.
It's something doctors and safety experts have been saying for a long time. Raphael Gibietta is a professor at the University of New South Wales at the Transport Road and Safety Research Centre. He says even in the workplace, quad bikes are profoundly dangerous.
What we found was extraordinary, that one in every two riders had experienced a crash, will experience a crash in their lifetime. Many experience many more, up to three, four crashes. And of those who did crash, about 70% of them were rollovers.
We've heard of two children dying over the weekend from using quad bikes. Should states be stricter in their regulation of them?
I think so, because it's time. I mean, the College of Surgeons have said it. We've said it from the Transport and Road Safety Research Centre at UNSW. Others have called for it from other institutions. It's probably time that things started to sharpen up on that. At that end, we get roughly about 10% of fatalities are children, and they're usually children under the age of 16. But young ones are particularly bad. I think in this case, they were under 10 years of age.
What makes the quad bikes so unstable that they do roll?
Well, they're particularly susceptible to rollover because of their narrow track width. When you look at the scale of stability and you think of a car, a sedan, then an SUV, then a big heavy overladen truck, big trucks rather, the big rigs, and then a heavily overladen truck, well, that's where the quad bike is. It's at the stability of a heavily overladen truck.
Only last week, the Consumer Watchdog urged the state and federal governments to better regulate quad bikes. Federal Assistant Treasurer Stuart Robert agreed action was needed, saying recommended safety standards should be implemented. The government is now calling for submissions to review the ACCC report. The World Today has contacted the peak body for quad bikes, the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, for comment.
Sarah White reporting. Well, it's hard to imagine a sporting comeback like it. Tiger Woods put the sex scandals and injuries behind him to take out the US Masters for the fifth time. Plenty had written him off over the years, but as he embraced his son Charlie at the 18th hole, no one was left in any doubt this was one of sport's truly great moments. The ABC's Quentin Hull has followed the Tiger Woods story through the ups and downs.
It's been 11 years since the US Open in 2008, and oh, how Tiger Woods' life has gone through an absolute roller coaster. He literally has gone from broken marriage to broken reputation to broken back, and now 2 years after the latest of four back surgeries, he's been able to win a fifth green jacket at Augusta at the Masters and have everyone gobsmacked, really, with the nature of this comeback.
And you don't have to be a golf fan, do you, to appreciate the mountain he has climbed here?
Look, you don't have to be a sports fan to know Tiger Woods. He absolutely shocked the world pretty much after he won the Australian Masters on our shores back in 2009. We got the signs that things at home weren't going well when he crashed his car back at Florida, and that was the early indication that the relationship with his wife, Elin, was on the skids. Then the scandals started to break about his philandering ways with women all across the world, and this seemed like one of sport's greatest falling from grace.
There was the mugshot, of course, Quentin, which is always the key moment for anyone's fall.
Exactly. I mean, a guy that seemed like had it all had then been reduced to, as you say, such humiliation of the mugshot. Of course, you know, he was a child prodigy, and his dad has passed of recent times as well. All manner of personal issues, apart from the fact that he was a guy whose body wouldn't let him do what he loved. His back was the most prominent problem. He had other issues with his body as well. But to think only 2 years ago at the Masters dinner, he was with his colleagues basically talking about the fact that he'd never be able to play again, let alone play at the elite level. And here he is now putting on the green jacket for the fifth time.
Do you have any insight as to how he managed to psychologically fix himself?
I think he's just an unbelievably determined individual. He obviously loves the game. It's something that no doubt he finds comfort in. It was just a matter of whether his body would let him do it once more. I mean, the scenes beside the 18th green were fantastic there with his two children, Sam and Charlie, and he's got his new girlfriend, Erica, there not too far away, along with a host of other support network around him. I mean, he's obviously a guy that has some very strong confidants. So no doubt that support network has been invaluable to him. But he's a guy, ever since he was a kid, he's been associated with golf. He was on network television in the States as a wee youngster. That's been his life. It's taken him to the highs. It's taken him to the lows. And I think he's used that vehicle to get him back to a place where he feels happy in life. And, I mean, that's, in a sense, the greater achievement than winning another green jacket.
Quentin Hull there. Winter is here. It's a phrase you're going to get mightily sick of over the next few days if you're not a fan of Game of Thrones. But the premiere of the final season of the show is an event millions of people have been waiting anxiously for. It's not an exaggeration to say that Game of Thrones has an almost fanatical fan base. And for these people, well, it's the TV event of a lifetime. Sarah Dingle prepared this report.
You know nothing, Jon Snow.
The first episode of the final season went up online today at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. This season is the culmination of 8 years of TV and 23 years of a book series, which, as any long-suffering fan will tell you, including your faithful correspondent, is still nowhere near finished. But the wild popularity of the HBO series means that the TV version overtook the books a long time ago, and there aren't many complaints. Digital content producer John Griffiths has hosted a Game of Thrones viewing party every Monday night after a new episode release for the last 4 years.
And there was furious screaming in my social media amongst my friends on the issue of spoilers. And the simple resolution to the matter came down to, I said, OK, I'm going to put on the pay TV. You can all come round to my house, watch it at 7:30 on Monday night, and then no one needs to spoil anything for anyone or get angry with each other about putting spoilers on social media. And since then, every Monday night, I've had to have people round and put food on for them, although they've gotten quite good at bringing snacks now.
And what do you do special things for the finale each season?
The finale is dress up night. So I myself have a dragon onesie. One of the dogs has a dragon costume, so that covers the dragon front. And we have various knights and priests and scantily clad women, yeah. It's very exciting to finally get some resolution to the story. I really want to see how it's all going to turn out.
Known for violence, explicit sexual themes, high fantasy, and a propensity to kill off some of its most loved characters, Game of Thrones is such a phenomenon that it's been thoroughly dissected online by everyone from fans to academics. Tanya Evans is a cultural researcher at one of the nation's most prestigious research universities, the ANU.
I think that Game of Thrones has a particular power for showing the different ways in which we can be men and women. So if you think about the series, I think it really shows us that there's a really diverse way that men can behave. So we can have men who are disabled, like Tyrion Lannister. We can have men who are bisexual. We can have men who, you know, feel their feelings and things like that. We can also see a really wide range of characters being women in very different ways. So we have characters like Brienne of Tarth being, you know, knights. We have characters like Arya Stark, who are these kind of feisty tomboys. So we get to see a range of different ways of being men and women. And I think that that's really something that has sparked a chord with our culture. And that's one of the reasons why the show has been so successful.
What do you think of George R. R. Martin's propensity to let his characters die?
I think that George R. R. Martin has a really long history working with the fantasy genre. So he has an expert grasp of what audiences are expecting and what they're not expecting. So when he kills characters off, he does it because he's really playing with those kind of fantasy genre conventions, and he wants to keep people excited in the series and to kind of keep people guessing as to what's going to happen next. So I'd say he does it very much on purpose because he enjoys it.
It's hard to put a number on Thrones watchers because illegal downloading of the show is rife. But each episode is watched by millions around the world. The show is so influential that it bleeds into the real world in often unexpected ways. fan John Griffiths.
It's the biggest show on TV. It's the show that the most money gets spent on. It was the top rating show in its last season in the US. And yes, there's a lot of violence. And there's also an issue that a lot of really horrible people like the show because they can see horrible people doing horrible things. And I'm still hoping there'll be some sort of happy ending and the good guys will pull it off in the end.
I may have missed the boat. That's all from the World Today team for this Monday. I'm Lisa Miller. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, Frank Kelly here from the Party Room. PK, the PM has called the election. We're heading to the polls on the 18th of May.
Yeah, and he called the election on a Thursday morning, right?
I know, weird, hey? And he's made it all about the economy and...
I believe in a fair go.
The fair go. Where have I heard that before?
A fair go.
Fair go, Fran.
Fair go, PK.
If you want political analysis, join us in the Party Room.
You can find it wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.